A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me on the program today. It is a 2-8 Tuesday. We've got a double dose of interviews for you. We're going to be talking with Paul Vallone from Grassroots North Carolina about the latest on constitutional carry. We're also going to be talking with Lee Williams from the Second Amendment Foundation about the Pulitzer Prizes that were announced on Monday. The Washington Post winning a Pulitzer for its 14-part series on the AR-15. Yeah, which, not a surprise. I mean, when a major newspaper runs a 14-part series on the AR-15, you would expect that it's going to get awards from their colleagues, right? Oh, how brave. Oh, how amazing. Pushing the needle, trying to get things done. Anyway, we'll talk about this with Lee coming up in just a couple of minutes. We also do have today's armed citizen story. Might even have time to squeeze in our good deed of the day and our recidivist report as well. But let's get started with Paul Vallone from Grassroots North Carolina, who is calling on gun owners to call House and Senate leadership today and urge them to get to work on a constitutional carry bill. Take a look and a listen. Paul, thanks so much for coming back on the program. It's good to see you again, sir.
Well, thank you very much for having me, sir.
Absolutely. So the first day of the legislative session, you dropped off 7,000 or so petitions to the Speaker of the House, urging him to get moving on constitutional carry. And now you're following up with some phone calls, right? Hopefully several thousand phone calls to the Speaker and the Senate President pro tem today.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Today, Senator Phil Berger, the President pro tem of the Senate, and Speaker Tim Moore are the beneficiaries of what I call a feedback day. A feedback day is where we ask people, and we, by the way, distributed hundreds of flyers at a gun show last weekend, asking them to participate. We direct hundreds, if not thousands, of phone calls to the offices between the hours of 9 and 11 on the first day that they appear for the week in the legislative session, effectively shutting down their offices. We've begun turning up the heat. The first thing we had to do with the petitions, we took a hand truck and rolled in about a 3-foot stack of petitions. And then we held a press conference on Senator Berger's doorstep. Senator Berger, because first off, he's probably the most powerful guy in the state, and nothing moves in the General Assembly unless he says so. And second, because last year he decided that we didn't, and I quote, need to pass constitutional carry. So, the paradigm shift was the first thing we did. We needed to shift the paradigm from one where people expected the bill to die to one where in which they understood that we are going to continue pushing for this thing. And we know perfectly well that there are manipulations of the rules that will keep this bill alive. And so the paradigm shift was first. Then we started dropping emails into their offices. And now the feedback day is the next means by which we turn up the heat.
Okay. What is the latest? Are you having an impact here, Paul?
Our press conference, Senator Berger said that he would actually consider, I think the way he put it was, let's see here. Constitutional carry is something that is worth talking about. We'll talk with our members and see if there's an appetite to move forward with it. Well, we're telling Senator Berger that the members who gave them a supermajority by which they have overridden several vetoes from our leftist Governor Roy Cooper, the people that gave them this supermajority are gun voters. And so we're the people they need to talk to. And so I said, well, Phil, let's talk.
There you go. You know, since the session began, we saw this awful shooting in Charlotte. Four police officers killed, four others wounded. And this has nothing to do with constitutional carry. This is somebody who is a, you know, violent career felon, should have been in prison, was not. Warrant was being served. So this guy has nothing to do. You couldn't legally possess a firearm. This has nothing to do with constitutional carry. But We all know the politics of something like this, Paul, right? When a high-profile shooting takes place, Democrats not only start calling for more gun control, but they object to any measure that would enhance or protect the Second Amendment rights of law-abiding citizens. What kind of impact has the Charlotte shooting had on the legislative session, you think?
Interestingly, I'm not sure there has been a discernible difference. And I think part of the reason is the media hasn't been playing this up all that much. And the reason they haven't been playing it up is that it pretty much proves our point. This guy had 41 previous felonies, all right, including, you know, a police chase and a variety of other things. He was being served a warrant for felon in possession of a firearm when the shootings took place. He has been let out by leftist prosecutors in Charlotte repeatedly. And we feel, if anything, that this proves our case. It certainly doesn't prove the case of the left. And so consequently, it really hasn't gotten quite as much attention as I would have expected.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, the deaths of the police officers have, but it has not been, you have not seen the op-eds, you know, pointing to this as a reason for gun control. You haven't seen a lot of politicians pointing to this as a reason for gun control. Which
they only,
you know,
they only dance in the blood of victims if it serves their purposes.
Right.
This doesn't serve their purposes all that well.
Yeah, exactly. All right. So I hate to ask you, you know, what's next, but what's next here after the phone calls and feedback day?
Well, I mean, you got to understand that we're in this for the long haul. We may or may not get it in the short session because they're going to break probably July or August. If I had to guess, they don't really say it right up front. So that they go out and campaign. But regardless, as we have seen in the past, we continue pushing for things on a multi-year basis. It took us probably, I don't know, 6 years to get concealed handgun reciprocity. It took us 10 years to get the purchase permit repeal. It took us 4 years to get Castle Doctrine and Stand Your Ground, but we got all of those things. And so if we don't get it this session, I can assure you we will reintroduce it. The sponsor will be happy to reintroduce this bill in the next session of the General Assembly, and we will continue pushing for it then. And I think we have a pretty good chance of getting it either this session or next session.
All right. Paul Vallone with Grassroots North Carolina. Thank you so much for the update, sir. Look forward to talking to you again very soon.
Thank you, Cam. I appreciate you having me.
My thanks to Paul for joining us on the program today. Now, before we get to our conversation with Lee Williams, let's talk about this for a second. At the very heart of our democracy lies a principle that we hold sacred, free speech. It's the cornerstone that supports every freedom we cherish. Yet in today's digital age, discussions about our wealth, our rights, and our future, well, they're being silenced or overshadowed in mainstream narratives, leaving many feeling voiceless in conversations that are crucial to our financial independence and security. This is where Wealth Protection Research steps in, armed with a mission that's never been more critical. Wealth Protection Research is not a financial advisory firm. They're defenders of free speech, committed to giving a voice to the silenced. Wealth Protection Research tirelessly seeks out financial experts. They're the voices that challenge prevailing narratives, especially as we navigate the uncertainties of the 2024 election. Wealth Protection Research has created a 2024 Election Wealth Protection Report. This free report highlights the three best ideas for protecting and growing your money heading into the 2024 election. It contains ideas that the mainstream media won't touch, and listeners can get it completely free. Text IDEAS to 76626 to claim your free copy. If you believe in the sanctity of free speech and the importance of financial freedom, then act now. Text IDEAS to 76626 to claim your free copy of this 2024 Election Protection Report. It's time to widen the scope of what we're told, to hear the ideas the establishment doesn't think you can handle, and to take control of our financial destinies. Text IDEAS to 76626 today to claim your free copy. All right, now let's talk with Lee Williams from the Second Amendment Foundation about the Pulitzers, including the one won by the Washington Post for its, again, 14-part series on the AR-15. We're not going to get into a deep dive into what the Post 14-part series looked like. I'm not going to spend hours fact-checking every part of that series. But I do want to talk with Lee about the anti-gun bias that is so present in the media. And I think the Washington Post series and the award that it has won is perfect evidence that this bias, unfortunately, is alive and well. Take a look and a listen. Lee, thanks so much for coming on the program, sir. It's good to see you again.
Good to be back, man. Thanks for the invite.
Absolutely. Well, when I saw the news of the Washington Post and won the Pulitzer for its 14-part series on the AR-15. You were the first person I thought of because you've got an extensive background in print journalism. And I wanted to get your take because Tom Knighton was shocked when I told him that the Washington Post won the Pulitzer. I said, are you kidding me? Like, this is what Pulitzers were designed for. You get a 14-part series on the AR-15 from the Washington Post. I would have been more surprised if this didn't win a Pulitzer Prize, honestly.
I agree completely. A bit of background. Awards have become a cancer in the mainstream media. I've never seen an industry that awards itself more than journalism. I mean, there are awards for everything. You cannot believe it. People think of the Pulitzer, you know, there's 100 others out there. And in award season, people will write stories for the awards. As an investigative reporter, I won a lot of awards. It's very easy to do. I had the luxury of time. Okay. Reporters are usually, your daily reporters are turning out stories every day or every other day. As an investigative reporter, I had 6 months or 18 months or the amount of whatever I needed. Mm-hmm. So those are the stories that typically win awards. And unfortunately, you'll see at a lot of newspapers now, almost all of them, they will write for an award. And when I saw this series coming out on the AR-15, I knew right away, well, that's their award story.
Yeah.
The interesting thing to me was that they won it for national reporting. That's not one of the big categories. The two big categories are public service and investigative reporting. That told me when they entered it in national reporting category, that it didn't have the chops to go for investigative reporting. And it really didn't, obviously. The story was flawed in 100 different ways. But, you know, you write a 15-part story on the AR-15 in the mainstream media, guaranteed to be an award winner, whether the facts are correct or not.
Yeah, yeah. We saw this in TV news as well. Every time, you know, sweeps comes around, you get those special stories and you're like, Why are you waiting until now to tell me what in my closet's going to kill me? You know, why don't you just tell me last week if you knew about it then? And you know, and I don't want to spend this entire interview getting into and debunking all of the flaws in this 14-part series. But what I do want to focus on is the bias here. I found a fascinating conversation with some of the reporters that worked on this story. At the University of Michigan, they sat down for, I think it was like an hour and a half long discussion earlier this year, back in January. And there were some really interesting comments in this discussion, Lee. Peter Wellston, who was one of the reporters, was talking about the impetus for this series. And he said, we asked ourselves and we sort of challenged each other, is there a way we can take a fresh approach? Can we find a way to bring new information to the public that might somehow shake loose this debate in the country that just felt like the same thing again and again? Another reporter, Sylvia Foster Frau, said it felt like a little more solution oriented because you're able to connect the dots of all these mass shootings spanning all of this time period. What is something they have in common? What is something that everyone should understand about why these things keep happening over and over again? That's such a fundamentally flawed premise here, because even the Washington Post notes, now it's, you know, small print tucked away in a couple of these stories, that handguns are still the primary weapon of choice in mass shootings, however you want to define them. And yet this entire series focuses on the AR-15. Right. Focuses on semi-automatic rifles as if that is the problem. The Washington Post made the false assumption, the wrong assumption, that it's the hardware that's to blame for these shootings.
What got me is, and in keeping in mind what you said, they were looking for a fresh approach. Unfortunately, they found one. I've never seen photos like they used in a daily newspaper. I mean, they are using incredibly graphic crime scene photos, the likes of which I haven't seen since I was a policeman. They, you know, when I was an editor at the paper here in Sarasota, we had every day we would decide, you know, what stories go where and what pictures go on the cover. And we had what we called the Cheerio test. Okay. You're not going to put a picture on the cover of the paper that somebody's going to read at breakfast the next day and throw up their Cheerios. That was the Cheerios test. And the photos that they used were so over the top, so salacious, so disgusting, They abandon all journalistic principles just to try and malign the AR. And like you said, you know, this whole concept of a debate is ludicrous. The debate ended for me in 1789. There is no national debate. There should not be. Okay. It is the most common weapon right now in existence. But yeah, their fresh approach involved breaking a lot of rules. But, you know, getting back to your bias question, you have no idea the amount of bias that is inherent in a newspaper newsroom. I worked in 5 of them, okay? Worked in big ones, worked in small ones. Over 20 years, I can count the number of gun owners on one hand, and I don't need all my fingers. Yeah. I literally worked with people that could not articulate the difference between a revolver and a shotgun. Now, there's a lot of rules in journalism that pertain to getting things right and what should happen if you make a mistake, okay? In print journalism, you're supposed to do a correction. If it's bad enough, you can do a retraction, which is huge. Never had that, thank God. But none of those rules apply when you're writing about guns, because I know that personally, because one of my colleagues would write a story and it would be chock full of errors, and I would point that out to the editor. I said, oh, don't worry about it. You know, you're just getting it. You sound like those crazy NRA people. Well, no, this is an error of fact. We strive for the truth. That's one of the main principles of journalism. You screwed up. This fact is completely wrong. Okay. AR-15s are not machine guns or stuff like that. I mean, I over the years, brother, I went off on so many errors. It's hard to track them. The reporter is never held accountable for an error when it involves firearms.
You know, you're right. But I also want to go back to what you talked about, the photos that were used, the crime scene photos.
Disgusting.
Because this was something that was also a topic of discussion during this a panel back in January. And what I found fascinating is there were so many reporters for the Washington Post who said, well, in essence, the photos that we used were a compromise. There was apparently a lot of discussion about whether or not to show dead bodies, and to use photos, you know, before these bodies had been removed. And the idea to them is that, well, if people see the damage that an AR-15 can cause, then that's going to affect them viscerally, right? And again, Lee, you know, as you say, it is shameful. Yeah. It is disgusting. Even if you had the approval of some family members, you didn't have the approval of all of them. And I do think that you need to be somewhat respectful to those folks. And I believe that as a journalist, there have been times where I've said, no, I'm not going to go to a funeral, for example. Right. I don't think it's appropriate for me to be there. I will interview the victim's family outside of the church, but I'm not going to do that.
Or on the phone.
Right. But this was, you know, apparently a big topic of discussion. And the Post reporters were patting themselves on the back for pushing the envelope, right? They said, well, we know what we're doing. We wouldn't normally do this. That was a common refrain, right? We wouldn't normally do this, but
except guns. So right. That's why they do it.
Yep.
You know, you can break all the journalism rules for if it involves guns. And I've been preaching that ever since I started. I've been preaching that for 10 years. That's what they do. None of the rules apply because guns. And every one of them, all the gun owners I met in newsrooms were all in the closet. I mean, when I started openly writing about guns about 12, 13 years ago, it was, you know, guys would come up, hey, you know, I have a gun. Oh, really? How horrible.
Yeah.
Because they have to keep their light under a bushel, so to speak, because they will be looked down upon when it gets out that they have a fire, because guns are bad for most mainstream journalists.
Yeah. Yeah. This is a quote from Sylvia Foster Frow. She said, we were wondering the merit at the same time that we were looking at the photos and kind of gauging our response to what we saw as part of like informing whether or not we felt like it had merit, because we saw things that we had never seen before. And we started to wonder, shouldn't everyone see this if it's happening in our country because of the laws that our country has put in place? Is this something that as a public service,
yes,
people deserve to know, right? I mean, there's that twisted ideology. And then just a couple of minutes later, Lee, the other reporter, Peter Walston, responded to a question by the moderator, and he talked about it again. This is right after his colleague says, well, you know, we wanted to put these crime scene photos out there as a public service. He said, you know, I know that we as a newsroom struggle with language because we're objective. We're not trying to push an agenda or a policy or advocate for one thing or another. Actually, that was Sylvia Foster Frow. Peter Walston said, we're not here to advocate for a particular position. Baloney, to put it mildly. I mean, that's what this entire series was about, advocating for a position that the AR-15 is a horrible thing, that it should be banned, that no American should own one. That was the entire crux of this entire series. And then they just, you know, try to drape themselves in this mantle of objectivity. It is infuriating.
Brother, I lived it. I mean, I lived it. I saw lie after lie after lie go into these newspapers about firearms. You got to understand, and taking a step back, today's young journalists aren't interested in being journalists, okay? They're not interested in going out and doing good stories and reporting the facts. They all want to be advocates. But even more than that, they want to be a brand, okay? If you wanted a really good newspaper, don't let your reporters have any social media accounts. Let them go out there and report the facts and put them in the paper. But no, it's all about followers. It's all about social media. And it's all about them wanting to be a brand. They want to know. They want people to stand up when they walk into a room. I mean, I'm talking kids fresh out of journalism school. Yeah. I go back to something one of my former editors said. She has two Pulitzers to her name and was the most objective executive editor I ever knew. And she did own a couple of firearms. She took a young reporter, went to work for her, and she edited the story. And the reporter went in to complain and said, you took my voice out of it. You took my voice out of the story. And she said, well, why don't you go win a couple of Pulitzer Prizes and then come back to me and we'll talk about your voice. It's they want their voice. They want their agenda. They want their point of view, as opposed to reporting the facts accurately. Yeah, that's how journalism has changed. And I got to tell you, I blame social media. All these kids have their accounts, and, you know, it's like, I'll write my story, but then I'm going to get on TikTok, or then I'm going to get on, you know, whatever, the Gram or Facebook, mm-hmm. or whatever, and promote it. And that's where I make my money. That's where I get my followers. And today in newspapering, it's not only about that. It's also about digital subscriptions,
right?
They track the amount of digital subscriptions that your story will produce. And if your stories aren't producing enough digital subscriptions, because paper's, you know, going the way of the dodo, that then you're going to get talked to. Maybe then you'll be allowed to be a little more salacious and a little more over the top.
Yeah, it's fascinating that you bring that up. I was talking with Andrew Malcolm a few weeks ago, and he was telling me about when he worked for the New York Times, and this was back in the 60s. You didn't have a byline, I think, for the first 5 years, you know, that you were reporting. You didn't have a byline. I know Time Magazine famously, at least in the 40s and 50s, same thing, right? All of their stories were written without attribution. Technology and times have changed. I don't know that it's possible to put that genie back in the bottle, but I think that you're right that the branding and the personality, right? It's not just about the story, but it is about who is telling that story.
Right.
And every reporter, you know, maybe this goes back to Woodward and Bernstein, right? Every reporter wants to be that famous, news hound who's breaking coverage. And if you do it, I mean, listen, if you do it the right way, there's nothing wrong with that, but this whole series, I think, really took the mentality of it bleeds, it leads, to, you know, atrocious new heights. And it doesn't stop here. I mean, that's the thing, right? So there was this big discussion in the newsroom about, well, should we show the bodies? Well, so what happens next year when a news outlet wants to win a Pulitzer? Do they say, all right, well, let's show the bodies. Let's take it one step further, right? What else can we do to try to, you know, drill into the brains of Americans that these guns are bad and they need to be banned?
Well, and what got me was their total fixation. It's not just the Washington Post reporters, it's the mainstream media itself. The total fixation on the alleged hypervelocity superpowers of the 223 or 5.56 millimeter round, which you and I and all your viewers know is an intermediate varmint round. I mean, 30-06... 8 millimeter Mauser, 7.62 by 54R, the traditional battle cartridges for battle rifles, infinitely more powerful than the 5.56. But no, they have to show how horrific this round is and the damage that it causes. You know, it's like, and I'll go back to what I said earlier, they just took all the rules and throw them out the window when it's about guns. The only one I did enjoy, the only one of the 14 stories I thought, because it put them in the trick bag, was the police conundrum. I forget the title, where they said, oh my God, here we have this rifle that's evil, right? But our law enforcement uses it. And it gets back to the old, well, it's an assault weapon, but it's a patrol carbine when it's in the hands of law enforcement.
Right.
And patrol carbines are good, right? Assault weapons bad. Yeah, it's, and like you pointed out, that little, the little bit of 11-point agate type where they said, yeah, but handguns are actually much worse because they cause a lot more death.
You know, and that to me, I think, is maybe the most egregious flaw of this entire series. It is based on this false premise. And we have a look, I mean, and Pete, excuse me, Lee, you see a lot of these false premises around, right? That we don't care about violence because we support the Second Amendment. We don't care how many people die every year because we care more about our guns. I mean, all kinds of these, you know, yeah, hyperbolic premises that are just flat out wrong. We do care about reducing violence, but we don't think that you get there by banning guns. I mean, that's plain and simple, right? This isn't a hardware problem. This is a human problem. Right. And that to me, I think is it's the worst thing, because not only is this advancing a gun control agenda, but it is distracting from the real solutions that I think can reduce these acts of violence by saying, well, if we just ban the gun, then all this goes away.
My only question that remains about this series, oh, and by the way, you'll notice that it tied, okay, with a Reuters story for national reporting. Reuters did a story on Elon Musk, okay? When you tie with another media organization for a Pulitzer, that's not really a good thing. But my,
like kissing
my
your sister?
Yeah, exactly. My only question is, to what extent did the White House Office of Gun Violence Prevention or did the White House anti-gun personnel that worked there for Joe Biden and are actually calling the shots, what role did they play in this series? Did they come up with it? Were they consulted? Did they help? Because everything that's anti-gov right now, I think we can trace right back to the White House. And I don't think this is any different. I think there's collusion here. And that, to me, would be the great story. That, to me, would be finding that collusion that exists between the White House anti-gun folks and these anti-gun folks at the WashPo. That, to me, would be worth a Pulitzer.
Absolutely. And you know what? If that story is written, it's going to come from someone like you, Lee, because it's certainly not going to come from the Washington Post, the New York Times, or any of the other major outlets.
Well, we'll see what we can do. I'm having a lot of work lately, unfortunately, coming on ATF. So we'll see.
All right. Well, listen, if folks want to keep up with your writing, how can folks find you online?
Everything I do is on my website, which is thegunwriter.substack.com, but everything is also at saf.org. Not everything. I'll do a product review. I'll put it on my website, but saf.org, SAF is in Second Amendment Foundation, or thegunwriter.substack.com. Speaking of SAF, you saw that two of our cases are going for that Supreme Court.
Yes.
They're gonna have their roundtable, their discussion. So hopefully, it appears that as though the Supreme Court will be taking up an assault weapon ban case, which would make this whole thing moot. And I just cannot wait for that to happen.
Absolutely. From your mouth to Chief Justice John Roberts' ears. Lee, thank you again for coming on the program, man. Look forward to doing this again soon.
Anytime, Cam. You take care.
You too. Thanks again to Lee for a great conversation. All right, I tell you what, let's just stick with our armed citizen story today. I do have a recidivist report, but I might actually write that up at Bearing Arms. If not, I'll save it for tomorrow. We can talk about it then. But just in the interest of time, we'll stick with our armed citizen story today, which comes from Omaha, Nebraska, where the owner of a Omaha jewelry store shut down thieves, or at least a thief, who tried to break in over the weekend. Garrett Petticord was at work late Saturday night. Small business owners, you know, sometimes the work never ends. He's filling orders on Saturday night when all of a sudden a rock gets thrown through the window of his store. It was about 11:30 Saturday night. Petticord is a goldsmith and the owner of a Cedrone Jewelers, said he looked up and saw someone jumping through the window on his security monitors. Now, Petticord is a military veteran, spent about 3 years deployed in Afghanistan. He also opened up a gun store called Athena Arms in Bellevue, Nebraska. So he had his firearm with him. In fact, he sprung up from his chair with his gun drawn and shouted, "Hey!" He says that was enough to make the man turn around and head outside the store. He said, "Thank my lucky stars, I put so much thought and time and repetitive training and practice into how to responsibly carry a firearm." Again, like most offensive gun uses, Petticord did not have to pull the trigger. The presence of that firearm, and maybe even the presence of him in the store till 30 at night, alerted the crook that, you know what, there's a safer place to be, and it's basically anywhere but here. Thankfully, again, Garrett Petticord had a firearm to protect himself. I'm glad that he did not need to pull the trigger, but definitely that gun was used in self-defense over the weekend there in Omaha, Nebraska. And that is going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms, Cam & Company. Looking forward to seeing you again tomorrow. We'll be talking with Rob Dorf from the Minnesota Gun Owners Caucus about the we got a lot to talk about. Gun control bills in the Senate. Got to talk about the Minnesota State Senator who was arrested on burglary charges, who has not been expelled by her caucus. She is still going to be a key vote on several of these gun control bills. So that's coming up on Wednesday or tomorrow, that would be. Yes. And we will have a full slate of Armed Citizen Stories, Recidivist Report, and a good deed to tell you about as well. Until then, though, be sure to check out BearingArms.com. We're keeping the website updated throughout the day with the latest Second Amendment news and information from all across the country. And if you like what you see, I'd encourage you to become a VIP or VIP Gold member. Just use the promo code SAVEAMERICA, and you can get 50% off of your VIP membership. You'll get exclusive content not available to subscribers. You'll get the ability to enjoy an ad-free experience. You'll be able to comment on all kinds of stories of Bearing Arms. But you'll also be supporting the independent pro-Second Amendment journalism that we do at Bearing Arms. And it is critically important that we get support from folks like you with big tech censorship on the rise. So thank you again for your support. It really does mean a lot to us. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Enjoy the rest of your Two-Way Tuesday. And I'll see you back here on Wednesday for another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam & Company. Until then, be well, be safe, and be free.